Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my inspiring conversation with mental health advocate and founder of Letters to Strangers, Diana Chow. We discuss Diana's experience as a first-generation immigrant struggling with bipolar disorder and how she turned her pain into purpose by encouraging others to write their truth. This episode is incredibly powerful, and I hope it will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Today's guest, Diana Chow, immigrated to the United States from China at just 9 years old. However, Diana was still bullied in school about her family's country of origin. At 14, she was diagnosed with an ocular autoimmune disease that would leave her blind for days at a time. Due to the staggering economic effects of the 2008 global economic crisis, Diana suddenly found herself as the family's primary breadwinner, working three jobs to help her family. To make matters worse, Diana also struggled with bipolar disorder and used writing to help her heal. She soon realized the power of the pen and decided to help others heal by writing too. Through Letters to Strangers, her nonprofit, Diana seeks to destigmatize mental health illness and increase access to affordable, quality treatment for young people. Letters to Strangers members write anonymous, heartfelt letters to share their vulnerabilities and to offer support for those who are fighting through difficult times. These letters are whatever the writer wants them to be, so long as they're authentic, and each is addressed in the same way, to and from a stranger. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Diana Chow. There are moments when you know that it's time to have a discussion, time to see the light, time to come out of the darkness. And today's podcast, it's relevant, it is meaningful, and it's going to be a very emotional exploration of feelings and empathy and having courageous conversations when needed and truly seeing humanity for who they are and who they can become. And that is our guest today. She has this secret power to see through people's souls, to be relevant and be relationship driven, but to be a gentle soul when people need that most. And she does so through words. She does so with her nonprofit, and she does so with a vision that we can normalize conversations around mental health. And being that September is Suicide Prevention Month, it is apt, it is relevant, and it is time for me to introduce our esteemed guest today, Diana Chow. Diana, I am so humbled and I'm so honored to be sitting beside you. And thank you for being a guest on the Freedom Writers Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's my honor and pleasure.
For our guests who have not watched your TED Talk, the first thing I'm going to tell them after this wonderful podcast, I'm going to insist that their homework assignment is to watch your TED Talk. It is spectacular. I was spellbound. I was weeping. And suddenly it was viral and around the globe. What was that like to go from someone with a vision and suddenly you are in people's homes, on their gadgets, on their computers, and they too are spellbound and weeping?
Well, you know, it's always been a very surreal thing. To give a little bit of context, so the TED Talk that I gave was on Letters to Strangers, which is my nonprofit. It's the largest global youth for youth mental health nonprofit today. But when I started it, I was a high school sophomore. So I was about 14 years old, and I just started it as a sort of student club at my high school. You know, at the time, I was using letter writing as my way of healing from bipolar disorder and suicide attempts. And I ended up thinking that, you know, if I can get my friends to join me in this little endeavor, maybe we can help each other heal, and that'll just be that. But what blew my mind away was that, you know, at first I had to bribe people with pizza to come to the lunch meetings.
Hey, I'm still bribing people with pizza.
Amazing. Well, just for everyone's records, she did not bribe me with pizza to do this podcast. although I wouldn't say no. But yeah, so, you know, even after our pizza budget ran out, people kept coming, and then people from nearby high schools, from other cities, found out about what we were doing. And, you know, at the time, there really was no major youth for youth mental health initiative. And given the generational gap, especially when it comes to technology, social media, and all of these impacts that are, you know, really ravaging a lot of young people's mental well-being that are really difficult for someone of another generation to relate to in the same way, people were really looking for that peer connection. And so it turned from this student club to what it is now today, a global nonprofit with over 100 active chapters in over 20 countries and still expanding. So that's kind of crazy for me because I never intended for that to happen.
My wish is that after this podcast, you will be in many more countries with many more chapters.
Thank you.
As you know, as a former English teacher with high school students, the fact that you are 14 and that you used words, not weapons, because for those that try to take their life, there is that risk of a razor blade or self-harm. Mm-hmm. And so as someone who turned to the pen rather than the blade, can you talk about what that was like?
Yeah, so, you know, these risks and harms that you talk about are something I'm very intimately familiar with. And I think it's interesting because, so I'm a first generation Chinese American immigrant. And when I moved here with my family at around age 9, none of us spoke a word of English. To this day, my parents still don't speak English. And so growing up, I was the only person in my family who spoke fluently in Mandarin and English, and I learned English by reading. I read everything I could find because I was tired of people making fun of my accent, tired of people laughing at me and calling me brainwashed. And so the irony of that is that as I'm writing these letters, you know, I'm writing in a language that is not my native tongue. But what I found so beautiful about it was that because it's forcing me to think in a way that, in a language that my brain was still not fully operating in, and use these terminologies that I read through fantasy novels, through these young adult books that were fiction but also so real in those emotions, it made me feel less alone. I think a lot of the pain I was going through came from my family, and that dialogue in my head was predominantly in Chinese. And so switching to this other language sort of also created a linguistic barrier between those emotions and the healing journey I was starting to take on. So I think that was where I really found that healing power and why I kept going with it.
I think what was so beautiful about the TED Talk we mentioned was you begin by reading a letter, and then you reveal that it is your letter.
Dear stranger, I don't know what to write, so I just pull on the bevels of my laptop keys with my fingernails. I pull and pull and pull until it starts to hurt, and I stare blankly at nothing until tears well up again. And I sob so hard, I wonder if my heart is wringing itself dry. I don't know what to say, except that sometimes everything hurts so bad, I don't know what to do. My arms quake and my legs shake, and I am a puddle. I am a string. I am a prayer wavering on existence, but never quite making it there. Hot cold burns up my arms. An elephant wakes up in my head. I can't think around it. I wonder what would happen if I tore this elephant out, dumped it onto a stretcher, and shipped it out of my brain. How would that weightlessness feel like? How do people live without that anvil seared inside their mouth? I wonder what it's like to laugh without having to claw your throat open first. Talking about mental health matters. Not because of everyone who cares, but because of everyone who doesn't. If we're going to destigmatize mental illness, we're going to have to start by embodying the power of writing in our daily lives. So listen. Ask questions. Think before we speak. Understand before we interject. Trust that these conversations need to be had. Don't you dare talk yourself down. Write a letter to a stranger. Don't be afraid. Learn and fight. don't joke about suicide, and don't equate someone else's difference to a guarantee of a mental health condition. Don't insist on yoga as the one-stop solution. And don't buy into the lazy, toxic weakness of stereotypes and the insisting of people that you are weak because of a mental health condition. Mental illness can mean battling dragons only to find their nests in our chests, and we learn to live with fire. So where is the weakness in that? How can there be weakness in that?
What is that like years later? To go back and read that letter, because when you wrote it, you didn't see faces and names and no anecdotes. And suddenly you're standing on a stage and you're reading your words and people are weeping.
Yeah, so I never thought that letter would see the light of day. I thought I lost it. And then when I was planning the talk, they asked me if I had any letters from when I was younger that I would be willing to share. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just dig through my hard drive, see if I can find anything. And I found that document. And I was like, oof, I don't know if I want to share this, but I think it really encapsulated a lot of the emotions I was feeling at the time. So I am glad today that I can use that letter as a sort of conduit to show people what I was going through without necessarily having to, you know, relive it brand new, because having that letter is almost like an artifact. And once I'm done reading that letter, I have a physical piece of paper to transport myself back into the real world with.
Mm. But the metaphors you use, like an anvil and an elephant, they're so graphic and descriptive. And so I love that even though English is your second language, I love that you think in terms of metaphors. It was beautiful to hear and so tragic. And when you found that letter, what was that like to find it and say, okay, this is what I'm going to read?
I definitely cried when I found it. It brought back a lot of the things that led me to that stage at that point. But I think it was also really empowering to be able to, you know, be at that point that I was 19. I had just turned 19 when I did that TED Talk. And I was in not as good of a place as I am in today, but still definitely better than I was when I was 14. So being able to, you know, look at that growth, you know, at the time, I didn't really think about how far I had come. But seeing that letter, it was a really stark reminder that even when you don't notice it, there is still growth happening and it's worth celebrating. Mm.
You mentioned in your work that you had a different kind of surgery when you were younger. And whenever there's an ailment or a surgery involved, people tell you you're so strong, you know, people who have cancer. But there's still that stigma and stereotype about overcoming mental health, because it's a lifelong diagnosis that doesn't just go away. So can you talk about that, how difficult it was when people on one hand were saying you're so strong, and then there was this elephant in the room that you didn't want to talk about being bipolar?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder when I was about 13. And then when I was 14, I was diagnosed with anterior uveitis, which is this eye disease / autoimmune issue that essentially made my eyes go blind whenever I had an episode. And so that would last for days, weeks, depending on how long it took for the medication they gave me to kick in. And we never could figure out the cause for it. So it was always just, okay, now it's finally subsided, but maybe I'll come back in a week, in another day. Who knows? We never know if that episode's going to be the permanent blindness. And so I had a lot of time in the hospital. I spent probably half of my high school career in the hospital. And I remember in my sophomore year of high school, in the spring, I had my worst episode, which was I woke up at 3 a.m. and I was like throwing up blood, and I ended up getting rushed to the ER where I fell into a comatose state and I was put on life support. And I think what really bothered me actually about that whole situation was after I woke up, you know, people, they cared about me so much more than I had ever seen anyone care about me, even after they found me in the aftermath of a suicide attempt. And I think, you know, the medical system in the U.S., for example, it has its ups and downs. And the good thing about being those hospital facilities for my eye disease was that it meant I also was part of a program that included a psychologist who would ask me how I was doing before each appointment. And it wasn't like, you know, comprehensive therapy, but it was still better than nothing. And it served as a sort of juxtaposition that made me realize the importance of advocating for mental health. But also, I think of how far we still have to go in terms of destigmatizing mental illness and recognizing that perhaps some of the more stigmatized mental illnesses, like schizophrenia or you know, things that people associate with extreme violence and such, that those need to be included in the conversation as well, because all mental health matters.
As a teacher, I'm a mandated reporter, and I have had to work with students who I helped have a 5150, which is in California, a 72-hour hold. And in certain cases, as a teacher, it was scary. You know, I'm the one that's driving them to the hospital. I'm the one that's sitting bedside and not sure they're going to forgive me for helping them get help. For you, what was it like when you were able to seek help? Was it preventative, or sadly, was it reactionary with your family?
So I never got comprehensive mental health help until I went to college. The help I got in a medical setting was basically all for my eye disease. And I just want to say that I think from my personal experience, as well as experience of my own brother and my friends, it's really scary for a young person to go to a teacher and say these things. Like, you know, I know the mandated reporter situation is very complex, you know, and it's oftentimes the best thing we can do in a situation. But I think what scares a lot of students is that lack of transparency by, like, the school administration about what follows the reporting. So when you are not sure what a hospitalization could mean, when you're not sure how you're going to be taken to the hospital, if it's going to be forced in front of all your friends, if you're going to be ripped away from, like, for example, homework that might be the only thing keeping a routine, a sense of normalcy in your life. And if this is going to put you in a bad light to all your teachers from now on, all of these fears, when they are not addressed preemptively, are a huge reason why students are afraid to seek help in the first place. And there is reason for that fear. A lot of schools are not very good at, you know, prioritizing the humanity of these students and instead perhaps care more about their liability concerns. And so from my own experience and those near me, we've seen firsthand how schools often will choose to hospitalize forcefully anyone who could even potentially have any slight inkling of anything. And I understand the concern, but I think it's a huge reason why we need to work on humanizing these conversations before it gets to the point of crisis, so that people aren't so afraid of being shuttled off to avoid, you know, a legal case or whatever else, because people are more than that.
Mm, you are so wise. I think for a lot of educational systems, we don't talk about it. When I got my teaching credential decades ago, that wasn't part of my training. And so I think a lot of the empathy I had was because I loved my students and I just wanted to do something proactively. So if you were talking to teachers, and all the things you just mentioned were fear-based for a student, mm-hmm. and for students who don't trust their teachers, but for talented teachers who have compassion, lead with empathy and lead with love, what would be some advice that you could give them so they could be that bridge for a young person to get help where there is fear, where there is the stigma and the stereotype? What could a teacher do?
Yeah, I think first of all, when teachers make, you know, mental well-being a common topic in their classrooms from the very beginning, it helps make a student feel less singled out when they do want to seek help. So for example, including mental health policies in your curriculum at the start of the year, or perhaps, you know, offering students like, oh, every Tuesday and Thursday, I am here eating lunch in my classroom if you want to join me, because you don't have anyone to eat with or just because you want to talk with me, it doesn't matter. You know, something like that can help a student feel more comfortable. When you build that relationship with a student, hopefully you can have that conversation with them where if something arises, that you as a mandated reporter feel the need to bring to a higher up. You can let the student know, like, hey, you know, I'm a mandated reporter, which means I have to tell the administration about this. However, I know there might be some fears you have about what happens next. So, you know, here's what I know from beforehand about the way that the school handles these cases. Here's some resources I know that could serve as alternatives. So if you don't want the school to send you to XYZ hospital, I do know that they will accept, say, notes from a therapist if you can show that you have this appointment set up for X number of weeks in advance, etc. It just sort of offer them proactive solutions to address those fears so that when they do get to that point where they might need to deal with administration, they aren't in fight or flight mode.
That's a great, great suggestion. We, as Freedomers, were really concerned about the pandemic triggering people's mental health and their well-being, and suicide is statistically the highest it's ever been. And in your TED Talk years ago, you talked about some of those statistics. I'm sure those statistics have been updated since, but you talked about 13 to 18-year-olds. You talked about how many people take their lives across the globe in a single year. So are there any statistics that you're aware of, since this is part of your nonprofit, that may astound our audience who don't know how rampant it is and don't know that suicide is the second leading cause of death in the United States of America?
Yeah, it's actually the second leading cause of death around the world now for young people around ages 13 to 34. And you know, what's astounding is, you know, suicide has increased by 65% in the last 40 years. And the rate of death by suicide is like double that of death by homicide in the U.S. And it's astounding, but I think what people also are perhaps more shocked by is how the age of someone who is dying by suicide can get lower and lower. Now we see news reports of six-year-olds dying by suicide. And I think I have a lot of thoughts on this, but you know, it just really highlights how even though we might want to push these conversations about mental health to when we think that the kids are more mature or more ready, the truth is mental well-being starts when your health starts, which is from the moment you are born. And so there will be more kid-friendly ways to talk about it, but the conversation needs to start as soon as possible.
So you said you were diagnosed at 13 and a half.
Yes.
When you had that diagnosis, and I assume that you were in either eighth grade or ninth grade, is that something you shared, or was it something you wanted to covet and out of fear, not share with friends, not share with your fellow teachers?
Yeah, so I was in eighth grade when I got the diagnosis, and I think you know, it's a little bit more normalized now, especially among the younger generation, to talk about a mental health diagnosis. But back then, I was extremely terrified, and I didn't tell a single soul. And I ended up telling maybe three of my best friends at most in high school. But what I was really scared of was just how people would react. And I think, you know, because I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, especially at the time, people were not as familiar with that illness, and they assumed a lot of things about it that really scared me from telling them about my health concerns.
And I think probably because of your age, you know, there's been a lot of people in the public eye who have been diagnosed with bipolar, whether it was a Britney Spears or a Kanye West, And you hear pundits making fun of them and making jokes. And I know those kind of jokes and pundits are cringeworthy, especially to anyone that's been diagnosed. So as a kid, if you would hear people talk about these people that others look up to and put them in a less than position, how did that make you feel as an eighth grader who might have liked this person's music or might have liked that person's movie?
Yeah, I mean, that was a huge reason why I didn't want to tell anyone about my diagnosis. And I think also, to be very blunt about it, as an Asian American immigrant, there were a lot of concerns I had also about the way that people treated me because of my skin color. And I think, you know, I was already very tired of people constantly reducing me to like a brainwashed communist or whatever else. I remember I used to wear this pair of red shoes all the time that I really loved. And I, you know, I grew up in Claremont, and the town when I moved here was like super, super white, like, I don't know, like over three quarters white. And so I was wearing this pair of red shoes, and this kid kept on saying, like, oh my God, you're always wearing those red shoes. How communist are you? And I just got so tired of it all that I just didn't want to give them any more potential ammunition to, you know, view me as that. Because I knew some people were going to say, oh, this must be because you're Chinese. That's why you're mentally ill or whatever else. And I don't want to deal with that. You know?
Mm. You know, for our listeners around the globe, the city in which we are interviewing mm-hmm. and the city in which Diana grew up is a beautiful college town,
yeah.
You know, very prestigious college town. And you ended up graduating from a very prestigious Ivy League college. But can you talk about some of that intrinsic pressure when you were in high school to get into a prestigious college and you're ill? You're ill with your eyes and these episodes. You're just understanding this mental health diagnosis and still trying to get straight A's. What was that like? And that internal pressure you must have put on yourself.
Yeah. So, you know, being a first generation immigrant and my family, when we moved here, we ended up losing everything because of the 2007-2008 recession, which is right around the time we moved to this country. I was the primary breadwinner for my family, and I started working like 3 jobs when I was 13. I was working on the Costco sample stand for like 10 hours a day on the weekends, just standing there yelling at people in my broken immigrant English. But I think, so for me, when I was doing like academic work, the pressure wasn't so much from what my teachers often assume, which is, oh, she's Asian, so it must be because of Tiger Moms or whatever else. It was never about that. But, like, my parents didn't put any pressure on me academically. It was more I wanted to get out. I wanted to get out of the economic situation we were in. I wanted to get out of the abusive environment I was living in. And for me, the only way I could envision leaving, but in a healthy and successful way, was to get into a really good university and hopefully with a scholarship so I don't have to worry about paying for it. So that was sort of my driving source. And I definitely ended up feeling a lot of that pressure, especially when you end up in like those college confidential forums when you're worried and all that. But I think ultimately, because I had that frame of reference that I think a lot of my peers did not have, when I had conversations about applying to college or these academic stresses with them, it grounded me to think about it from the perspective that I was living with.
So many of my original Freedom Riders had 2 or 3 jobs, and so many of them were the primary breadwinners. And I love that you were able to have that opportunity to go to another coast and go to school. And for a lot of Freedom Riders, that scared them. Like, if I leave, what happens to my family? And how are they going to pay the rent? And I'm sad that must have been a thought for you as well, that, you know, you're pursuing your dreams, but there's also that going back to the anvil that probably held you back of, is my family going to be okay? Are they going to be able to keep that roof over their head and put food on the table?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember one of my friends got really mad at me in high school because I wasn't going to apply to any colleges. I was just all like, I can't leave them here. And my friend just yelled at me. I was like, what's the point of all these grades, all these accolades you've accumulated if you're just going to throw it all away like that? So I was like, okay, fine, I'll apply. And I think also it was a necessary step for me because a lot of my trauma came from the environment I was growing up in. And I don't usually give too many details about that just because I think people like to impose a lot of their own stereotypes about like Asian American families or whatever else onto my experience. And I don't want to propagate that. But in loose terms, I needed to get away from my family if I wanted to start truly healing. So that prioritization of myself, both economically and health-wise, was probably the scariest risk I had ever taken, but one that I needed to do if I were to survive, and I'm glad I did it.
You know, I've always told my students that they're like homing pigeons, that if you give someone freedom and you open the door, they will fly away. And then they come back. So I think it's a beautiful full circle that you did go away, but we are full circle. We are back in the town of which you grew up. And what is that like coming back with a different perspective?
Yeah, I am much better at standing my ground, at drawing my boundaries, at resolving conflict. And I think also because of my work, my family has learned more about mental well-being, their own traumas, how intergenerational hurts people, and trying to break that chain once and for all. And so even though there will still be moments that remind me of those younger days, I am very grateful that my work has allowed not just me, but the people I love and care about to recognize that we don't have to live in pain forever.
Mm. I love that you focus on giving voice to the voiceless, and you do so anonymously in the way that the Freedom Riders wrote their stories anonymously. And can you tell us about Letters to Strangers?
Yeah, so Letters to Strangers started because after I got my diagnosis, you know, I was trying to see a therapist. I was trying to see the psychiatrist who diagnosed me consistently. But the thing is, you know, I needed legal guardian permission. And I tried to, fake my way through that. But that doesn't work very well. And so I ended up not being able to get that consistent help. And so I turned to writing. And now, you know, we operate through three main ways. The first is our anonymous handwritten letter exchanges, which happen on student campuses, as like clubs or in local communities, and are usually based on art therapy informed themes and guiding questions, followed by a peer trained led discussion. And then the second thing we do is our science-based peer education, which includes, and I'm really proud to say this, our world's first Youth for Youth mental health guidebook, which we published in November of 2019, and it's like almost 80,000 words long, but that's because it's a very, very comprehensive deep dive into mental health and from an intersectional perspective that I felt like was critically missing. You know, really deep investigations into how race, ethnicity, age, gender, religion, all these things can affect your mental well-being. And it was written entirely by 14 to 21-year-olds and reviewed by medical and industry professionals from over 50 countries. It's also for free to download on our website, letterstostrangers.org. But of course, the physical copy, which is fully illustrated as well and in color, is a wonderful thing to purchase if you are into that sort of thing, and it helps support us.
Yes, and yes, and yeah. I think for a lot of us older teachers, we love holding books. So yes, yeah. You can download it, but support the cause.
Yeah.
Buy the illustrations and have a tangible copy in your classroom.
Yeah.
I'm excited that you brought some letters with you.
Yes.
And I think that's what drew me to you. A freedom writer came to us like a message in a bottle and said, you have to watch this. And I was sucked in. And I just did as much research as I could to learn as much as I can about you. But it was the reading of the letters that really drew me in. So would you honor us and read a letter that you selected to share with the audience?
Yeah, let me pull one up. Dear stranger, I wish you could hold the paper on which I'm writing these words, this inconsequential paper filled with words written in desperation to bring you some solace from the constant battle raging on inside of you that the world refuses to acknowledge, and know that you are not alone. I refuse to leave you alone. And even when you think that the world has turned a blind eye towards you, know this, that somewhere on this planet, there is a stranger ready with a paper filled with words, strongly rooting for you, shouting your name from the crowd. I don't need anything from you. I don't need you to be super successful or be utterly happy or be the loveliest person or be whatever else the boxes on list of a person with good, meaningful life says you have to be. Rip it up and throw the list out of the window. I already love who you are as you are right now, utterly, deeply. You've come from being who you were and are on road to who you are supposed to be. And I hold all the versions of you close to my heart. You don't need to feel guilty about your being or lacking because I am in awe of how brave you already are to feel and think as deeply as you do when others would much rather just numb everything down. You have the courage to be you in this ever so transient world, and I am such a fan. All the love, stranger.
Mm. So tell us about how you selected that letter.
Yeah, so, you know, we started our letter writing exchanges on student campuses, but when the pandemic hit, we ended up launching early our custom-coded letter exchange platform, which is also accessible through our website. And we've exchanged over 5,000 letters on there now, but this was one of the first letters that came in. And I think, you know, we have a whole moderation team that makes sure everything is okay and all that, but I think this one really struck a lot of our moderators too, because everyone was feeling something during that time, and it's just so relieving to feel validated in the act of feeling, you know?
I love that it's cursive and it's online paper. And, you know, oftentimes so many people go to their gadget, to their phone, to their laptop. And I love the arts of the pen or a quill or whatever people are using. When you sit down to write, I know you like to use stationery. Is there a specific stationery that draws you?
So given the way I grew up, I was always writing on the backs of envelopes, on the backs of scrap paper, all of that. So I think that always still brings me a sense of serenity.
And when people submit the letters, do they have a letter that was sent to them prior to respond to?
So the way that we take our letter exchange approach is, it's not a pen pal system. It's more like a message in a bottle. So when you send a letter out, you will get a letter back, but it's not that the person is responding to your letter per se. You don't know who's going to read your letter, and you don't know whose letter you are getting. But perhaps you're, you know, connected by writing on the same theme, based on the same guiding questions, etc. And our hope with that is to give people sort of a blank slate, a fresh start of sorts, so that they don't feel pressured by, you know, maybe the need to know how to perfectly respond to someone, or a fear that now that, you know, someone has built a connection with them, they have to stick to this, you know, personality that they first wrote with, but perhaps now they want to be more open and they feel like they can't really shy away from that. You know, that's sort of what we're trying to take a different approach with our letter exchanges.
I love the term message in a bottle. As a 13 and a half, 14-year-old, you didn't have that shore to throw that bottle to get that message out. And that must have been really difficult to not have somebody be able to write a letter to you like you just read that was full of empathy. And like it's a cheerleader kind of letter where they're so positive and the word you read was in awe. What would that have been like as a 14-year-old Diana to receive a letter of that magnitude?
I think, you know, one thing we try to emphasize with our letters is it's not supposed to be like a Hallmark thing. Like, of course, you want to be supportive and empathetic, but the way we want to see that empathy is through your own vulnerability, through your own human connection. And so I think what I really appreciate about this letter and that I wish I had gotten when I was younger was, instead of just someone telling me, oh, you'll be okay, which like, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I guess logically I can tell myself statistically I'll probably be okay, but like in that moment of feeling, I am not going to accept that. But like rather just really feeling the other person, even as they're trying to comfort me, knowing that they are also being really vulnerable themselves and sharing just so much empathy with me, that makes me feel the message a lot more and makes me take it more seriously.
There's more letters. Will you do us the honors and read another?
Yeah, this one was actually literally typed on a typewriter. And yeah, it goes like this. Dear stranger, 2 years ago, I lost a king who turned his crown into a halo. He had everything you could have imagined that came out of a humble upbringing. Looking at him, you would have never guessed he had a hard time burdening that crown. He traveled the world, had a stable job, was in a relationship, played piano for his church choir. Literally anything you can name, he was able to do it. He was my role model and, most importantly, my childhood friend. But what I learned is that the weight of the crown doesn't signify the physical symptoms of those wearing it. Some may find ways to make it lighter. Some put a smile but cry alone in silence. We all wear a crown, but no two crowns are made the same. I just wanted to take this time to say that you are absolutely loved, even if you don't feel this way. There are two things that I've learned from this that I want you to know. One, if you think the world is a better place without you, you are wrong. The world is such a brighter and more lovable place knowing you are here. Your smile, your humor, your grace, all of that leaves a gaping hole in the hearts of those who you've touched. We love you, we cherish you, and most importantly, we need you to continue this fight. Because at the end of the day, we would rather break down with you in a corner of a room than seeing your entire existence fit into an 8x8 wooden box. This is an image I can never forget out of my mind. 2. No one looks at you any different, knowing you carry the heavy burden. In fact, I wish I knew sooner so I can find more ways to love you. Your hopes, dreams, and ideas, we wanted to hear them all. We wanted to help you make them a reality. When you cease to exist, so do all these wonderful things. Your struggles are beautiful, and your scars are not ugly. Your body is capable of many things, and whether your scars are from mental trauma to physical harm, it is your body trying its best to heal you. Down to your final moments, your body will refuse to give up on you, and we won't either. We love you lots. We want to hear from you. Please let us help carry your crown, because at the end of the day, your kingdom is here to celebrate your coronation into a beautiful and wonderful person. The world refuses to lose another king or queen with so much to offer. Love you lots, a stranger. Mm.
Listening to this podcast are a lot of kings and queens, a lot of crowns. So what would you say to those listening that the crown is heavy, that the burden is overwhelming?
The thing is, you know, we are so often stuck in this feeling of being alone, even when we are surrounded by perhaps what others would perceive to be all the signs that are signifying we are not alone. And what this letter taught me is that the crown is something you might be told all your life to cherish. And your life could be beautiful or it could be miserable. I don't know, right? But the thing is, people will always tell you how that crown should feel. But you are the one bearing it. So you decide how it is affecting you and what you want to do with it. And if what you need to do is throw it away for a crown that feels more comfortable for you, then you have every right to do so. And if you need to take it off for a while to borrow someone else's crown that's maybe a little bit lighter, maybe a little bit more comfortable, you are allowed to do that too. Make it work for you because it's yours.
For the people, the kings and queens who seek out this membership in these clubs and decide to write these wonderful letters, do you find that many of them are willing to have conversations with mental health because they in turn are learning about their own mental health? Like, who do you think these clubs attract? Who do you think these letter writers actually are?
Yeah, so one of the reasons why we're called Letters to Strangers all this time and not something like youth mental health or something like that, it's because I remember when I first started this, I was, like I mentioned earlier, terrified of talking about mental health. And I was afraid that if I started something with mental health in the title, that it would automatically associate me with a mental illness and then people are going to judge me. And so a lot of the people coming to our clubs, because they were curious about the name itself, and it allows them the freedom to talk about mental health without feeling like it thereby associates them with a mental illness. And you often see this really beautiful transition where someone starts their first few letters and it's like, you know, they're trying to get a little bit more vulnerable, but it's like a little bit awkward. But then over time, they're just telling these beautiful, heartfelt stories because that emotion has been in them all along and they just needed to feel validated in expressing that with someone else.
You put into words everything I was hoping my students would do when they chose to write Dear Freedom Writer. So I'm going to spare you from the letter that was written by the student, only because the students are anonymous. Mm. And so maybe you could start here. Mm. And then this is the response from a freedom writer.
Mm. Okay. Although I had not successfully taken my life, a part of me died in the institution. I lost faith in myself and in the system. How could what I went through be called treatment? Thankfully, free from dehumanizing detention, I realized that I still needed help, and I sought true treatment from a psychiatrist who properly diagnosed me and put me on medications that have changed my life. I came to realize that I am not broken, but the system is. Wasn't it the institution's job to help me heal? I know that others have been helped by institutional placement, but there must be a better way to help people who suffer as I did. I am still haunted by the trauma from that time, but now the voice in my head tells me that I am worthy and life is worth living. Sincerely, not broken. Letter 45, the voices in my head aren't mine. Response. Dear Not Broken, like you, I heard voices too. My voice told me that I wasn't worth loving, I felt like I was always going to be trapped, and that my life was always going to be miserable. When I was 28 years old, I had enough of my life. I was not going to just pray to God to let me die, I was going to do something about it. Miss G found out and took me to a psychiatric hospital. I remember sitting in the cold hospital lobby. A young nurse came and sat in front of me. She asked some questions. I gave honest answers. After the short question session, she told me, "You are going to have to stay here for a little bit." I do not remember much, but I do remember crossing the double locked doors, walking to the nurse's unit, and having everything taken away from me that I could use to kill myself. My shoelaces were taken off my Converse shoes. I had to either remove my bra's wire or not wear a bra. I couldn't have any pens or any jewelry. When they took my cell phone, that was the final nail in the coffin. I was not free anymore. Once I was admitted, I didn't know what to do or what was going to happen to me. I was scared. I walked into a large rectangular room that had round tables surrounded by sterile-looking chairs. There was a TV in the corner of the room that was set to an old movie. I cautiously sat down at one of the tables where there was a sweet-looking girl sitting down. She looked up and smiled. I remember her dark shoulder-length hair and brown eyes. I smiled back. She asked me, "What are you here for?" I was a bit stunned. She could tell I was hesitant. That is when she said, "Don't worry, we're all here for something." She pulled up her sleeve from her arm and exposed what must have been 30 different cuts on her arms. That's when I realized, fuck, I am struggling with mental illness big time. Since I was 12 years old, I had hated life. My childhood was riddled with trauma that left scars. Coupled with a mentally ill mother, I felt doomed to have some sort of mental illness. My days at the hospital were surreal. I had group meetings with other people that were undergoing evaluation and weren't free to leave. My thoughts were either occupied with, how am I going to get out of here? Or figuring out ways I could kill myself in the hospital. I started to incorporate Freedom Rider activities into group meetings. I was talkative and engaged with others in order to show the hospital staff that I was okay. When they would ask me, "Are you feeling like you're going to hurt yourself or others?" I would say no. After 8 days of playing the game, I got my get out of jail free card. This time, I was standing at the nurse's station to get my freedom back. The final symbolic breaking of the chains was when the nurse cut my hospital wristband. She was going to throw it away. I stopped her and asked her if I could keep it. "Why would you want to keep this?" she asked with a puzzled look on her face. "So I can remember what I need to do to not come back here," I said. Like you, I was deemed cured, but I had no idea how to live. That was the first hospital treatment I had ever received. I was diagnosed years later with bipolar depression too. I had come to terms with lots of things. First, in my understanding, this is a lifelong disease that cannot be cured. I will inevitably have another depressive episode because I have no control over it. I've had a couple episodes since my hospital stay 13 years ago. In the latest one, I was in an outpatient facility. I had to accept the reality that an episode will happen again. And however, I learned there are some things I can control to hopefully keep me out of the hospital. Mental health treatment is not a one-size-fits-all approach. You have to find what works for you. If you're unsafe and need help, don't hesitate to ask and go. For me, a combination of medicine and cognitive therapy was key. Over the years, I have had my medications changed, added, taken away. Also, it is important to have a mental health team. Traumatic, but you can come out of this stronger than you were before. You are right. You are not broken. The system is. That is why it is important to tell your story and use whatever platform you have to show the world that you are not broken, but the system still is. While doing so, it is important you find the right path for you to live a healthy and happy life. Sincerely, Now Mended.
So the author of that response is Sue Ellen, who led us to you. That was the first time she's heard somebody read her letter. What was it like to have somebody read your letter aloud as you're sitting there cringing on the couch?
First of all, it's terrifying because it's like going back to that dark place and remembering that. It was, all I can think of was like, what can I say to make someone feel better and realize how important it was and to be given this platform to tell not only my story, but to show and try to normalize and show that, like, even though it may seem overwhelming, that they could come out on the other side. And I still am a work in progress, and I will always be a work in progress. And before, I was very terrified of that, but now I have accepted it, and I realize how important it is to embrace that. So it is very strange hearing my story and my words. And as you were reading the letters, I was like, oh my God, my letter is not going to be as articulate.
Oh,
it's not
going to be like this. No, don't even say that. That's not true.
But it's my truth. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that... what was so touching about reading your story and seeing that you actually are taking action. What I love is empowering youth, and you are empowering youth. So I thank you for being that for future generations.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for just, you know, really pioneering a lot of that willingness to be vulnerable and to recognize that it is in fact very much a strength. And it's my honor to be able to share a little bit of your story. I hope people recognize just how much it must have taken for you to get to the point you are today where you can, you know, share that story as a message of hope rather than as something that you might feel very dragged down by. So I'm very grateful for you for that.
You know, sometimes under that cloak of anonymity, you have a little bit more strength and you're a little bit more intentional and present. It's very similar to an AA meeting where people come and they're anonymous. Mm-hmm. So I love that you've continued to have the anonymity be a part of this project. And do you think the anonymity gives people a lot more freedom?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because, you know, a lot of the folks who join us, they perhaps found out through me, and a reason why they were attracted to this was because perhaps I looked like them. And so there's a lot of cultural or other intersectional things that are going on in their stories that they might be afraid to talk about, but because of that anonymity, they feel like they can't talk about it without, say, you know, bringing shame onto their families or whatever else.
You know, this has been a year of racial reckoning, and one of the most recent podcasts we did was to stop Asian American hate. Mm-hmm. And so as a young Asian American, has it been difficult for you and your family as people have been prejudiced and put their own prejudice against you and your family members during this really difficult pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my family makes Chinese food, and it really pissed me off when, after the pandemic started, we got all these comments from people saying that they would never eat anything disgusting from the Chinese, things like that. And for a lot of us, food is our love language, you know, especially when you grow up really poor as an immigrant or whatever else. The only way you can try to show love is by feeding someone so that they are not starving. And so to lose our ancestral recipe because of this hate, we ended up having to remove the word Chinese from all of our packaging. And I remember the day my dad asked me to do that on the packaging design, and it just broke my heart. This is a story of my ancestors passed down through generations in our rural mountain village. You know, these recipes are the way we keep going. But I think, you know, what it also meant was that more people were becoming aware of the fact that Asian Americans exist, that we are not just the invisible model minority, we're not just the perpetual foreigners, we have been here for a very long time. The earliest Asian settlers in the U.S. came before the U.S. was even a country. And so I am really grateful that we are having this conversation now where Asian presence is recognized. And I hope that it continues in a positive trend.
When you talk about the love of people, you talk in terms of humanity and seeing your humanness. And oftentimes people don't see. You know, there's a lot of people who feel invisible and are marginalized. And you're very passionate. You even have almost like a slam poetry way of reading your letters that do sound very poetic. So what is that like when you're challenging people to see, to hear, to notice, and most importantly, to matter?
Yeah, I think those younger day jobs that I work definitely helped. Nothing quite like telling a customer trying to return a product as you are, you know, an eighth grader trying to stand for like the 10th hour of the day that no, you cannot take the returns. And so I think it taught me a lot about just not taking BS, basically. And also, I graduated 3 months ago with my major in geosciences, my minor in history and diplomacy. And a big reason for history is because as I learned more about the history of my people, both in this country and beyond, and also the history of all peoples around the world, it really humanizes the stories of the generations. And having these facts with me also helps a lot with really standing my ground when people try to, you know, say that, oh, you're a foreigner or whatever else, so you shouldn't have a say in what's going on in this country. Well, I'm like, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen. I am a hyphenated American. That doesn't change the fact that I am American. And I think, you know, just knowledge is a really powerful thing. And I am really, really grateful that we're living in the internet age where we can, you know, research these things and validate the histories of the people who came before us and the people who will hopefully come after us.
When you do your work, I'm sure there's this unspoken language when young people come up to you and you can see the scars from the cuts, from the self-harm. And as you're doing now, you're nodding and you're acknowledging. So what is that like when you are present and that physicality of someone coming up to you without saying a word, but their scar says everything?
The thing about scars is they take on very many different forms, but that doesn't mean they don't hurt the same. And I think what a lot of these people and myself have learned over the years is that maybe this is a club we don't want to be in. Maybe it's a club we wish didn't exist. But it is also a club that reassures us that we truly do not walk this earth alone. And, you know, I'm glad that I didn't really start talking publicly about my mental health journey until after I left the environment I was in, because I don't think I would have been in a healthy enough space to do that. But because I was in a better mind space, I was able to have these deeper conversations that were really vulnerable, but also with a tinge of hope. And so I think the thing with scars is, you know, you don't want to necessarily turn everything into a metaphor, but if you do, scars are supposed to help you heal, like in that letter I read earlier, you know? And so even though they are perhaps a visible signal of pain, they are also a sign that healing is constant. It might be so slow you don't even see it at times, but it's still there and it's going even when you want to give up all other hope.
I love that as someone who's so open now, and so public, that it's trying to pull others in, that you feel alone. And what is that like when you finally feel like I am no longer alone?
It's kind of a scary thing to believe because to be honest, I was really upset and angry when I was younger because whenever someone would try to tell me that they knew how I felt, it was usually someone who came from a very different background than me. And I'm not saying that, you know, emotions are not universal, because they often are. But it was still difficult to really take into heart the idea that they understood a lot of the implications of my life when they didn't live through those same cultural or whatever other, you know, restrictions or good points or whatever else themselves. So I think when I finally, you know, met other people who looked like me, when after I started going public with my story and these people came up to me afterwards, they were so glad to see someone who looked like them tell a story that felt very familiar for them. But I was also really glad that they came up to me to tell me that I was not alone, because I really believe that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to find a kindred spirit, at least not in this town. So I'm really grateful that I was able to learn that I am truly not alone. Mm.
Our name Freedom Writers is an homage of civil rights activists, one in particular, John Lewis. Mm. And John Lewis, one of the original Freedom Writers and congressman to boot, told the Freedom Writers about missions and mandates. Mm. And I believe that Letters to a Stranger is just that. It's a mission and it's a mandate. Mm. So with a global audience, tell them about your mission and tell them your mandate.
Well, our mission is to destigmatize mental illness and increase access to affordable quality treatment. And my mandate is to make sure that we all educate ourselves on mental health. You don't have to be a psychologist. You don't have to go really deep into Wikipedia, but understand some of those stereotypes and misconceptions that might have been perpetuated, basic tenets of how to seek help, how to support each other, and recognize the importance of self-care, not just from bubble baths or face masks, but practicing, you know, physical motions or mental strategies to get us to a point where we can help someone else as well. That's my mandate.
Before you were diagnosed, you were in a dark place.
Yes.
So I want you to envision a 13-year-old Diana who had not been diagnosed, who didn't have a name for what she was feeling. I want you to talk to that 13-year-old, because someone is listening to this podcast today who is a 13-year-old Diana. And I want you to be their light. I want you to be their humanity. And most importantly, I want you to be their hope.
I can't single-handedly change the way that you or anyone else feels. And I can't promise you that everything will work out exactly the way you want it to. But what I can say is that you truly never know what the future holds. And maybe it's a scary future, but also it could just as well, and perhaps even more likely, be a future much better than any that you could have ever hoped for. And I know that maybe you don't want to trust me right now, but I want you to just, for yourself or for anyone that you care about, or even for a fictional character, or I really don't care for who it is that you're doing this for, but I want you to take that risk for another day, for another week, for another month. Give life a chance to prove the doubts in you wrong. I know for a lot of the younger folks, students, etc., who are listening to this, you probably are living the same sort of social media space I am in right now, where you hear a lot more about mental health. And that's a good thing. But what I also hope for us is that as we talk about mental health more, we also follow it up with education. Sometimes misinformation can be more harmful than no information. And so I've heard from, you know, high schoolers I work with that at their school, anxiety and depression are like not cool anymore. Like, people now are saying the new trendy thing is bipolar disorder. And of course that terrifies me, because, you know, that thing almost killed me. But I also understand that it's not out of bad intentions, but rather perhaps just people not understanding that your mental well-being matters, whether or not you meet the diagnostic criteria for mental illness. You are allowed to seek treatment for preventative purposes, not until you have a diagnosis to quote-unquote justify it. So let's, you know, be kind to each other and practice mental well-being, not just because it is a buzzword right now, but because it matters for all of us, regardless of what time we're living in.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Diana Chow, for bravely sharing her struggles with mental health and helping others to overcome it too. My dear listeners, may each of us be kind to one another. May we validate the feelings of others. And in Diana's honor, may we destigmatize mental health conversations to create safe spaces in which everyone can share their struggles. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. We'd like to thank our publisher, Penguin Random House, for allowing us to share a sneak peek of our upcoming book, Dear Freedom Writer. The excerpt read by Diana Chow was written by original Freedom Writer, Sue Ellen Alpazar.
Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.